It's a funny thing talking about the Dharma, isn't it? Because I think I always end up feeling like I don't know, like I'm talking about this elephant, like a sort of like vast woolly mammoth. And it's like whatever you say, it's like you're describing one corner of a toenail, or kind of like a little tuft of hair on the side of its ear, or something like that. And and you're just trying to get this vast woolly mammoth. I mean, what I really want is this vast woolly mammoth to kind of come through that door and kind of race through here, trumpeting with its ears out, and kind of go, look, it's like this. Have you got it? It's this. And then, like, nobody could ignore this kind of massive woolly mammoth that had kind of just run through. However, I don't think I can quite manifest a woolly mammoth. So let's see what we can do talking about Kshitigarbha a bit. Okay. Right. So we had a bit of an introduction yesterday to Kshitigarbha, this figure that we've got sitting here with his staff, wizard's staff. With the six rings for the six realms on it, and holding the jewel, this wisdom family figure who is stepping down with his left leg, bringing clarity, wisdom, and stepping down, particularly associated with the most difficult areas of experience, with the hell realms. And he's often, he's associated with lost causes, areas where it's just like, what's going to help here? And he'll still step down. And I think the central question that I'm going to be trying to unpack a bit in the manner of a mammoth's toenail is, why is it wisdom that we need to go into dark and painful areas of experience? Like, why isn't it? Why isn't Kshitigarbha stepping into the hell realms? Why is he not a compassion figure? And of course, like, in a way, he is, because it's like, actually, we can split out wisdom and we can split out compassion to think about them, or, as approaches. But actually, it's like, someone who sees reality clearly is responding with compassion, and somebody who is responding with compassion is not overwhelmed and they are seeing reality clearly. So it's just like which entrance you go in at. But what is it in particular that Kshitigarbha is bringing? So I've got four bit parts to this talk. So first, I'm going to tell you a bit of a story from a long time ago. Then I'm going to talk about the nature of hell realms. Then I'm going to talk about habitual responses to painful experience, particularly anger and blame. And then creative responses to painful experience. And I've got the forgiveness and patience. And I didn't quite know what to call the next bit, but it's something about like action and effect. It's like how things have an effect. Right, so that's where we're going. Okay, so this is a story from the time of the Buddha, and it's a story from a set of texts called the Terigata, which some of you may have come across. So they're actually stories and writings about women practitioners at the time of the Buddha. So you'd have all these kind of, I mean, they call them nuns, but it wasn't like, they all lived in a convent. It wasn't really like that. Actually, many of the poems are very kind of succinct and poignant. They're actually the earliest records of women's spirituality. Which is quite nice. So I'm going to tell you a story of one particular woman living at the time of the Buddha, who's called Patakara. So her story was, so she was living in Sarvati, which is a town in northern India where the Buddha spent quite a lot of time. And she fell in love with a man that her parents disapproved of. I think he was probably lower caste or something like that. And despite her parents' disapproval, she married him and went to live a bit of a way off with her husband. And she'd had a child, and she was pregnant with her second child, and she really wanted to go home to her parents, and her husband didn't want her to. And she set off anyway. And there was a big storm, and it was very, very bad weather. And her husband followed her and found her, and she'd left it too late, and she was giving birth by the side of the road. And her husband went off to try to find some shelter for her, and he didn't come back, and she didn't know why. And so she gave birth to this baby by herself in the night. And the next morning, so then she had to, you know, she had, like, I don't know, say a 2-year-old and this newborn baby, and she just set out to carry on trying to go to her parents. And she discovered that her husband had been bitten by a snake in the night and had died, and that's why he hadn't come back and found her. So she carries on trying to get to her parents, and there's a flooded river, and she tries to cross it with her children, and in that process, both of her children are killed. She can't manage to get them across this flooded river. So she's just lost her husband, her newborn baby, and her 2-year-old. And she carries on to Sarvati, where she goes to her parents' house, and a bystander says, "Don't go there, don't ask me what's happened to them." And she finds the smoking ruins, and her parents have just died in a house fire. So, you know, she has all this bereavement in a very, very short space of time. And what happens is she just completely loses it. She goes mad. And she just starts wandering through the streets, and her clothing is all kind of like ripped, and she just kind of like wanders around like this, and she lives that life kind of unhinged on the edge of society for a number of years. And then one day she just finds herself in the Jetta's Grove where the Buddha happens to be. It's not that she's gone to find him, it's just that, you know, she's wandering around in a crazed state. And so she's going over to where the Buddha's teaching, and people are kind of, you know, trying to shoo her off and saying, you know, like, you know, "Go away, mad woman, you can't, you know, you can't come in here." And the Buddha says, like, you know, "No, let her come." So she meets the Buddha, and the Buddha just looks at her and takes her in and says, "Sister, recover your presence of mind." And the impact of how the Buddha is so powerful that she does recover her presence of mind. And she says to him, she just says, "Help me." I don't know why I get quite so emotional about this story, but I do. I think, you know, she just says to him, "Help me." And he says, "Don't think that you have come to someone who can help you. In your many lives, you have shed more tears for the dead than there is water in the four oceans." And then he tells her about the Buddhist path, quite simply. And at the end of that, she says, "Okay, I want to practice this." So he takes her to a group of female Buddhist practitioners who take her in and teach her the Dharma. She practices the Dharma very seriously. She becomes enlightened, and then she becomes quite a major teacher in her own right, with other, you know, women disciples at the time. So I think there's a number of reasons why this story really makes me think it's something about what Kshitigarbha is saying. So I mean, the first striking thing about it is it's like the first thing the Buddha does isn't anything about, like, he doesn't rush out and fix anything for her. It's just like there's something about the way that he is that means she can just recover her presence of mind, and she just says, help me. And there's something in that where, like, do we take seriously enough how we are in the world and the effect that that has on other people just by our presence? And then it's like there's actually what he says to her, because it's quite strong, isn't it? You know, if somebody like that came up to you, you know, him saying, don't think you have come to someone who can help you. You know, he doesn't say, well, don't worry, you know, I can see you've had a hard time, but, you know, you can marry again and, you know, you can probably have more children, you're still young, you know. He says, I can't help you. And what he means is, I can't help you in the sense of, I cannot fix the world so that it's going to be the way you want. There's nothing I can do to mean that your children are not dead, your husband is not dead, and your parents are not dead. And this is the nature of being alive and compounded, impermanent. You know, we live, we die, we experience suffering, we experience joy. So in a way, he's giving her quite a strong teaching about impermanence is the way it is. And there's something about that where he's able to meet her level of extreme suffering without turning away. You know, he's not saying to her, oh, that's fine, you know, you know, that's not really painful, that all that bereavement has just happened to you. Because he's able to stay with that level of painfulness in himself, he's able to really meet that level of painfulness in her. And that's incredibly powerful to be able to do that. And then finally, he tells her about the Buddhist path. Because if you just hear... well, yes, everybody you know is going to die and so are you. I mean, that's pretty bleak, isn't it? And actually, if that was all there was, it probably wouldn't be terribly helpful to look at it. We'd all be a lot better off just going and leading lives of straightforward hedonism and kind of ignoring that. But because he's saying, actually, we can completely change our relationship to this. Okay, you may be in whatever state you're in at the moment, other people may be in whatever state, but there is always, there is potential for creative change, like that's never not present. So I just thought I'd tell you about a modern example of this, because you might sort of think, oh well, that's the sort of thing that happened to people 2,500 years ago. But this actually, okay, so this was maybe 2 years ago. And we do have various people that sort of just turn up at Taraloka for various reasons in their lives. And we had a woman drive up in a car. And it was pretty obvious that she was suffering from mental health difficulties. And she ended up being fed by the retreat, actually, and then we took her over into the house. And what had happened to her is she did have quite major mental health problems, and she'd become pregnant. She'd given birth to the baby, but because of the severity of the nature of her mental health problems, social services had taken her baby from her at a few days old and put the baby into foster care. And of course she found this incredibly painful, and what she was doing was just like Patakara. It's like she was wandering around in her car, mm-hmm. which was full of like baby seat, baby blanket, baby mm-hmm. clothes. And she was just finding anybody that she could to talk to and she just wanted to show us her baby photos, the pictures she'd been sent from the foster mother. You know, oh, this is my, you know, this is my baby in the little tiger suit that I sent last month. And it was sort of heartbreaking and incredibly painful at the same time. And it's like there was nothing that I could do to make it okay for that woman, because she, you know, she was obviously having severe mental health difficulties, and she probably wasn't able to look after her child. And yet she was suffering this level of, you know, bereavement from her baby that she loved being taken from her. So that's probably one example of a hell realm. So moving on to sort of like just talking about like what is the nature of being so, what is the nature of a hell realm? And it's like when you're so overwhelmed by painful experience that it feels like really there's very little available to you in the way of creative possibilities. I mean, this is why the human realm is said to be so great for practicing, because we have, you know, we have a level of painfulness that makes us want to move, but not, but also like a level of pleasure and joy in our lives that mean, you know, we're able to be more open to creative choices. So we can have hell realms that are external. So if you are being tortured by the American military in Guantanamo Bay, you are in a hell realm and your possibilities for creative choice are very limited. Anywhere in the world that there's genocide or war going on, domestic or child abuse, we can probably all think of like lots of different examples. I was on the convention, the Order convention recently, and I met a Kshitigarbha practitioner, and he said, oh yeah, I made a connection just straight away. I was a policeman, he said, and I worked in child protection. And yeah, immediate connection. And then we can have internal hell realms, which are like, you know, depression, mental illness. But also I think anybody can go in and out of a hell realm. And quite often actually on newcomers retreats, we get people that have hit such a point in their lives that they just know that something has to change, and here they are. And actually I don't think it's uncommon to have quite extreme distress on retreat in general. You know, it's like when things start arising, and it's like sometimes it's like you can't believe that you're experiencing quite that level of painfulness. But yeah, generally, if more someone more generally is in like an internal hell realm, it's like, you know, they're locked in. You're locked into your own suffering in a way that makes it extremely hard to step out. And quite often, I think there can be a combination of like external factors and internal factors. Like with that story of Patakara, it's like, well, she has this external, horrendously tragic occurrence. But in a way, on its own, that wouldn't be enough to put her in a hell realm. But I would imagine that she's also thinking, I don't know, for example, why did I try to cross that river? It's my fault that my children have died. Why did I tell my husband to go and find me shelter? Or she might be thinking, my parents, it was all down to them. If they hadn't have thrown me out, none of this would have happened. So it's like you've got the external circumstances, and then we've got what our minds then do with the external circumstances. So quite often there can be like this combination going on. So we can probably see quite clearly that the nature of hell realms is they're very hard to get out of because of that locked in nature. So because of that, it's like something needs to come in from outside. And that's like the Kshitigarbha principle, just something coming in from outside. there's a woman who's a friend of mine, and she was telling me that she'd got to a really seriously low point in her life. And, you know, I won't give you the details, but it was pretty low. And something happened where a friend came round, and the friend said, "Look, let's play a game of chess." And they played this game of chess, and in the course of that game, my friend felt her mind, like her quality of mind, change, where she was sort of focused and absorbed on the game of chess. And she told me, and that was the turning point. It's like she realized that something else was possible. There was something different, a different experience she could have with her mind. And that was the start of her thinking, okay, where am I going to go to move away from this really difficult situation I'm in? So I think the first thing somebody in a hell realm needs is just simply relief, like maybe rest or just like a micro bit of pleasure, or just for the suffering to stop temporarily. So when we have the Buddha stepping into the six realms of the wheel of life, what he's bringing is healing balm, just to alleviate the suffering a bit, and then that can let a creative choice arise. Which was a bit like the chess in a way. And then, yes, the other thing, just that there is an alternative. It's like there is a different way. There is a way out. I mean, I do think it's really, really important to make the point that it's like two things have to be present for someone to escape from a hell realm. One needs to be this thing coming in from outside. So Claire was telling me about when she was in a very difficult state, going along to the Buddhist centre. And I remember meeting Claire like about that time, and she'd come and she'd garden. She'd do the Buddhist center garden, and mostly not talk to anybody, as I remember, but you come and do the garden. And it's like the way people were at the Buddhist center was giving an alternative. But then on the other hand, Claire had to get herself there. Nobody could get Claire there for her. So there's always got to be two things. There's got to be a receptivity on the part of the person in the hell realm, like they've gone to rock bottom. And they can see, actually, like, there's got to be another way. And then there's this thing coming in from outside. But if the person doesn't have the clarity or the receptivity to realise that, like, there is no, you know, there is no way of helping that person. Not that Kshitigarbha would ever give up. So then there's this other quality of the hell realms, which is to do with this receptivity, because, well, there's this Chinese Mahayana system where it talks about like the number of Buddha seeds in the different realms, and there's kind of bad seeds, which are suffering, and there's good seeds, which are skillful action, ethical action, and then there's Buddha seeds, which are just going directly for liberation. And the human realm has about equal numbers of these seeds. Actually, the God realm has very, very few Buddha seeds. There's no motivation to go anywhere out of the God realm. And the hell realm has the biggest number of Buddha seeds in it, in proportion. There's all these painful, bad seeds, and there are very large numbers of Buddha seeds. And the reason is because if we're in such a painful state, well, it's obvious to us that we don't want to stay as we are. So if there's any way out, if there seems to be any creative possibilities, well, we're not sort of hanging on thinking, well, I don't want to rock my relationship, or I'm not sure that's going to work with my career plans. We're just not going to be thinking like that. We're going to be thinking that is the way, and we're just going to go for it. So like perversely, that level of suffering can also be a very strong, I don't know, opportunity. It can be, it doesn't have to be. There is plenty of people suffering severely in the world and not, you know, that's not what's happening. Okay, so Sangharakshita says about this, I like this. He says, the suggestion, which in a way seems outrageous, it does, is that when we are in a state of intense suffering, the next step is to gain enlightenment. But it does make sense. All worldly hope has foundered. All we can do is head straight for enlightenment. It's as though there were another strange affinity between a supremely negative state and a supremely positive one. This time, between extreme mental suffering and an aptitude for the highest spiritual attainment. So I think that speaks to me very strongly of Kshitigarbha, because, you know, there he is, just going into these hell realms and shining the light of that jewel. And he's saying, look, this is the Dharma. And, you know, that can really catapult people out. Okay, so what are our usual responses to painful experience? So I'm sure we could come up with a very large list, but I've got three here. And the one that I particularly want to focus on is anger and blame, but I'll go through all of them. So first I've got, okay, so our usual response to painful experience is we ignore it and we avoid it, if at all possible, which is perfectly natural, I have to say. But quite often it's like it's on an unconscious, wired in level. We've got an area of, it's like, that's painful, I just don't want to think about it. And so it just sort of slides out of our experience. And sometimes, of course, we have whole strategies in our lives to avoid coming into a relationship with painful experience. So when I very first became a Buddhist, one of the first things I noticed was I always had the radio on. So wake up in the morning, Radio 4, Today program, three political arguments before breakfast. You know, as soon as I got home, Radio 4... some more political arguments to my supper. You know, I was never in the house and it be silent. And as I started practicing and I tried turning the radio off, I just noticed that what that meant was I had to be with my own anxiety. I had to be with my own sense of painfulness. I had to be with my experience, and I did. That was not pleasant. That was not pleasant at that time. And now we cause, and now, you know, we can broaden out beyond the radio to Netflix and Facebook and all sorts of other things. But I do think this ignoring is quite, it's almost like, because it's so automatic, we don't even notice we're doing it. I think I notice, particularly with regard to big issues in the world, like climate change or like all the refugees or something like that, where it's like I sort of want to engage and I kind of start thinking about it. And then it's like the level of painfulness that is what's happening is just so much that it's just sort of slides off again. Mm-hmm. And then later I realise, oh yeah, I just completely slid off that. It's very hard to stay with. So then we've got horrified anxiety and fear. It's unbearable. Somebody should do something. Help, help. Which looks like activity, but it's rooted in helplessness and fear. And I'm not going to say any more about that. And then we've got anger and ill will. And again, this is a very natural response. It's like there's something really painful happening either in our life personally or in the world. And we get angry. We think that shouldn't be happening. It's someone's fault. It's all down to them. And of course, there is a big difference between anger, which is like this, just this frustrated energy, you know. There's this painfulness coming at us. We, you know, none of us would sit here and think, what a great idea, let's have a refugee camp in Calais with all these displaced people with hardly any services. Nobody is going to be thinking, what a great idea, I'd love that. So it's painful. So what we are doing is we are encountering painfulness. And our response is, we've got painfulness coming in, and we don't want it, we just want to go push. We don't want that to be happening. And that is anger, that's just this frustrated energy that we do not want that. But it is a variant of ill will, and it usually does fix somewhere in the world, and we'll come onto that. But of course it is also quite, you know, it's like you've got all these variants of ill will. So you go from anger, which is just this sort of explosion, through to kind of like hatred, really wishing other people ill, and malice, you know, enjoying and wanting to cause people harm. And obviously it's a very, very wide spectrum, with, you know, anger being the soft end and malice being the hard end. But they are all responses simply to pain in our experience and us not wanting to stay with pain in our experience. So I'm just mentioning a couple of typical views that I meet on anger. So one is anger is really bad, and as good Buddhists we mustn't ever feel it, and we should never never have any anger anywhere. That would make us really terrible, because it's so destructive. Okay, now can you spot why that doesn't work? So of course that completely, I mean, for a start, it's just like a natural human emotion. So as long as we, you know, unenlightened human beings, that's anger is going to arise. But also, so what Kshitigarbha would say is, well, if you're feeling angry about something, well, actually, clarity, that is what you're feeling. And you can wish you weren't feeling that. You can wish you were feeling love or compassion or something else. But actually, the place to start is the place that you are feeling. Now, the other view that I quite often encounter about anger is that, so the first view was anger is bad. The second view is anger is good. So the anger is good view is, you know, anger gets things done in the world. Nothing would change without anger. Anger shows I care. If I wasn't angry, I wouldn't, you know, I would just be indifferent. I wouldn't care about things. And again, that's an understandable view because, of course, like there are things kick-started in the world because people have got angry and thought, look, this isn't okay. Let's do something about it. However, if that anger is a recurrent way of being, then it isn't helpful in the long run. It's like adding more poison to a system that already has poison in it. So if that view resonates at all, you could just try asking yourself a few questions like, when you've been very angry, have you ever tried to communicate with somebody? And did it go well? Have you ever worked with somebody who gets angry frequently? And what was that like? Or lived with somebody who gets angry frequently. And if you're a person who gets angry frequently, which I am, by the way, what is that experience like for you? Is it pleasant? Is it painful? Do you find it helpful in the long run? What does that actually do in your life? So when we think about anger, we often think that, we sort of say, they made me angry. So in the community, people always leave things on top of the dishwasher. We've got a dishwasher, but they leave them on top of the dishwasher. And I say, well, they made me angry. So we're sort of putting the anger out there. We're saying it's coming from the world. But actually, like we were talking about, like this, all that's happening is we've got a painful experience coming in. We don't want something. And it can be that whole range from like a really painful world issue to the cups on top of the dishwasher. And what we're doing is we're just pushing it away. We're doing aversion. And of course, the other thing that we do is we do craving and we do greed. But, that's not the area we're going into. And if we have that as a habitual response, so like, I hear about the Calais jungle and I think that ought not to be allowed, it's outrageous. And the cups are on top of the dishwasher and I think, how dare they, we've got a dishwasher, can't they even turn the cup upside down and put it inside? I mean, honestly, what is the world coming to? What's happening is it's like I've got a habit going on in me where it's not like I sort of think anger is just for these terrible things happening in the world. It's like I've got an aversion response that kicks off whenever something happens that I find a bit painful. So a few years ago, I was working on a project with somebody that I found seriously difficult. And we got into a lot of conflict, and I was working quite closely and intensively on this project with her. And it was awful, actually. I'd sort of think, why are you so aggressive? Why are you always having a go at me? Why are you always being awkward? I don't understand what's, all I have to do is walk in the room and you say something sharp. And I was very, very angry with her. And she was very, very angry with me. Even though our communication did improve over a number of years, I still found her very difficult, and even though our communication had improved, it's like I still thought she's this really difficult person. She's got all these difficult traits. Everybody finds her difficult, so it's all her. I am the victim of this difficult person who is making my life a misery. And then what happened was she stopped working on the project I was engaged with. And there we go, she left. And what happened was I had lost my enemy. And it was this really, really uncomfortable feeling where it's like I had this sort of roving anger. And I didn't know where to put it. And it was really uncomfortable. And actually, it made me feel quite unsafe. There was something about kind of like knowing where the danger was coming from in my life. It's sort of like the danger looked like this particular person, and it was this shape, and it did this sort of thing. And if I knew where it was coming from, I could defend myself against it. And then that shape had sort of walked out of my life a bit. So what happened after the kind of really uncomfortable me feeling unsafe was I noticed it was almost like I had this big top hat that was just floating around the community. So this was when I was living at Tara Loki, and it sort of float around, and it would just sort of drop over the top of somebody's head, and I'd be furiously angry with them for this thing that they did. I mean, honestly, that way they behaved. And then, like, a couple of weeks later, it would sort of float off them, and it would float onto somebody else, like somebody that I'd never had a problem with up until the person that was kind of like my fixed enemy had left. And I must say, that continues to this day, where I've got this sort of floating top hat of anger that just kind of, you know, it's almost like, where is it going to hook itself next? And I'll be so angry at that person. So Sangharakshita talks about each of us having a quantum of negativity. It's like we've each got a habit, a certain habit of aversion. And no matter what our circumstances, because that is a habit in us, we are going to find something to be angry about. But I so didn't realise that before I'd had that experience. Okay, blame. So blame is like choosing one aspect of and saying like it's that, you know, the fault is there, it's their problem. And we've probably already noticed that, you know, like we were talking, I was saying notice in the check-in this morning, that blame ping-pongs between it's on us, it's our fault, and it ping-pongs out, it's their fault. And, you know, one is like, it's their fault, I'm innocent, I'm a victim. And then out there is it's like, it's their fault, they're terrible, they did it to me. And I don't know about you, but when I'm in the middle of that sort of blame battle, it does feel like being in the middle of a battle, doesn't it? It's like you've got all these shouty voices going one way and these shouty voices going the other way. And you, it's actually very, very tiring. So the Dharma is a landscape without blame. And what that means is basically conditionality. So it's like I can look at this person that I had a lot of difficulty with and I can blame her for this incident. Actually, okay, I was, I think a better way of explaining this. When I worked as a physio, we had a lad come in to the hospital and he'd broken his leg badly up here and he'd been joyriding a car. And what he'd done is he'd driven this car head on into another car and he'd killed the two occupants. And he was about 19. And generally the people working in the hospital were not terribly kind or sympathetic to this chap. Because, you know, basically he had just killed two people. And I had him in my physio clinic. And it just sort of transpired. It's like, I suppose I just learnt a bit more about his life and a bit more about his life and a bit more about his life. And it's like he'd grown up on this sink estate in Sheffield. He'd gone home to his, like, he lived in a sort of hostel. And when he came back, he was in all this pain and he hadn't taken the pills. And the reason was he couldn't read. So he couldn't read the bottle to read what he should take or when. And he'd been too embarrassed to tell the nurses about that. And he was not a pleasant character, okay. But when I sort of heard about how he'd grown up in this very, very difficult area of Sheffield, in a broken family, with a whole sort of social situation, it's like, where was I going to put the blame in that situation? Was I blaming him for being born to a single mother with drug problems? Was I blaming the mother for having had a baby? But then what were the conditions that had led to her having a baby? Was I going to blame the social system that meant that that family hadn't had enough support? Was I going to blame the politicians? But then what had caused them to make the choices they make? You know, the more I looked at that situation and I tried to think, okay, so what part of conditionality am I going to blame there? Who do I blame? What do I blame? The more it's like you take it out and out and out and out, and what you've just got is everyone who's ever been alive, all the physical conditions, the biological conditions, the social conditions, everything kind of rolling on and having an impact on everything else. What part of reality was I going to choose to blame for that young man killing two people in a car in Hillsborough High Street? And in a way, it was easier for me to see it with that young man because I didn't have a big emotional loading. It was relatively neutral for me. But of course, in my life, when I have a blame scenario going on, it's not like that, is it? You think it's their fault. It's their fault. But actually, it's like we're picking just one part of reality and choosing to blame that part. So that's one aspect of this clarity that Kshitigarbha brings, where he just, you know, he just shines this light from his jewel everywhere, and says, okay, you're just looking in this very narrow direction. But get perspective. Which part of reality are you going to blame here in this situation? And it is a good question to ask, actually, when you get locked into a blame. You know, okay, what are the conditions that have led to this thing that I'm blaming? And blame is a defense against experiencing the level of painfulness that we would have to be with. Quite often, it's like we have emotions in layers. And these defenses, anger, horrified, anxiety, ignoring, they're like the top layer. I think of it like a sea. You know, you know how when you swim in water, it's like you've got different layers of temperature, haven't you? So at the top, you know, you've got this furious anger or this blame. And what that's actually doing is it's saying, I don't want this painful experience. But then it's like, can we let ourselves sink deeper into that sea and see, okay, so under that anger, what are we experiencing? And there will be something more painful, like grief or shame or devastation. And we can just like drop through these levels of painfulness. And at the bottom, it's just like there's just this deep sadness that I would not choose that painful things happened in the world. I mean, I was talking a bit this morning about this work that I'm doing at the moment about my childhood and my mum. My mum was schizophrenic and that had certain consequences when I was a child. And it's like if I can just drop through the layers, and there's a big layer of anger and blame, you know, those things should not have happened. But like when I get to the deepest level, it's just sadness. It's just like that was what happened. That was the situation. That was incredibly painful to have that happen as a very small child. And yet that's just fact. Like that did happen. That was painful. That just was how it was. And a kind of like calm and quietness, which is quite different from the sort of blame arguing, like it's my fault I wasn't a good enough daughter, it's her fault she wasn't a good enough mother. Just dropping under that and experiencing the devastation that actually that was what was happening. And it's like that's like what the Buddha was saying to Patakara. She's saying that was devastating and that is the situation. we do not realise how much suffering we cause for ourselves by resisting pain in our experience. It's not that that level of pain, of, you know, suffering, isn't there and isn't real and isn't excruciating, but actually it's nothing to the painfulness of keeping pushing it away. But there's a lot of fear. We fear being overwhelmed by the painfulness of it, and that can come up very strongly when we try to meditate, actually. Okay, so a few positive things. So we are going to blame, and Kshitigarbha says, just notice, don't take it too seriously. Sometimes I just have my mind going, yeah, and I just almost have to look at it. I have to imagine, who was it mentioned a Muppet this morning? I have to imagine a Muppet just here, and I think, yeah, this Muppet is just going to sit here and carry on going, yeah. I'm just not going to listen to anything my mind tells me for the next day. It's going to carry on going, yeah. I'm just going, right, okay, background radio. So that's this sort of perspective, seeing clearly, stepping loose to our experience. And all this also is aspects of kshanti, which usually is translated as patience or forbearance. But what kshanti really means is not reacting to painful experience, which is exactly what Kshitigarbha is doing. He is not reacting to painful experience. And actually a word that works for me a lot better than patience is forgiveness, as the opposite of blame. So it's like, can I forgive myself for this level of painfulness in me? And can I forgive the world for being painful? That's all it is. Can there be forgiveness that the world is this painful? So one final thing about Kshitigarbha being the Bodhisattva of lost causes and the Bodhisattva of hopeless situations is it's like we can trust that an ethically good action will have a good outcome. So if okay, so the example I've got here is we did a protest at Taraloka with some local Sangha members, and we went and sat outside Sainsbury's to protest about John West using these fish aggregating devices that just kill everything in that bit of ocean. And we did a quadruple metta bhavana, sat outside Whitchurch Sainsbury's. And it was incredibly powerful, actually, the experience of doing it, people looking and just feeling that we were modelling a response where we were saying, I really care about the world. I do not think this is okay. But we weren't shouting. We weren't angry. We weren't waving things. We just had these placards explaining the situation and actually praising Sainsbury's for its own brand tuna, which is line fished. And then we were just sat there looking completely vulnerable and doing the metta bhavana, and people just stared. And the response that I had afterwards from quite a few people when I was telling them about it was like, I'd tell them about it and then they'd say, oh, so do you think it had any effect then? And now, can you see the issue with that? It's sort of like they're thinking, there's an agenda which is like, we're trying to get Sainsbury's to say they won't stop John West. Did that happen, yes or no? And it didn't happen. But on the other hand, was there an effect from 11 of us sat on that pavement with all the pizza adverts and the people going beep on the cash machine and like modelling something, was there any effect from that on the people who saw us? Yes. Was there any effect from that on us for sitting there and publicly saying, as Buddhists, we don't think this is okay? Yes. So it's like, it's almost like letting go, having a difference between our action and a fixed agenda, but just trusting that actually if we're acting out of love and clarity, that effect, there is going to be an effect. There can't not be an effect. And we can just trust that. We can just trust that. So, Patakara, Patakara became a teacher, and actually amongst her, the women who came to her and followed her were many who came out of the hell realms, as well as, you know, just women who were coming from all different walks of life. And Patakara left poems, and also some of the women she taught left poems. So I'm just going to finish with the enlightenment poem of someone taught by Patakara, who herself came out of a hell realm and had such a positive effect on the world because she was able to be with her own level of painful experience. So this is from a nun called Uttama. 4 or 5 times I left my cell. I had no peace of mind, no control over my mind. I went to a nun I thought I could trust, Patakara. She taught me the Dharma, the elements of body and mind, the nature of perception, and earth, water, fire, and wind. I heard what she said and sat cross-legged 7 days, full of joy. When on the 8th I stretched my feet out, the great dark was torn apart. So that took a bit longer than I thought it was going to.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
So, I don't know if anyone has any particular comments or questions before we head to the shrine room. You don't have to have.
Recently, a man came over from China and was given us a very warm man from China, actually. I was really struck by him because some other Chinese people come over before to teach us Qigong have been a little bit stern, but this man oozed warmth. Mm-hmm. And he was all very, you know, this Qi field is coming from you. This is, you know, I'm not a master and that kind of thing. So it was really effective. But at one point, because our Qigong group always happens on a Wednesday above a pub, and I do have a drink afterwards with a couple of men sometimes. But we was all sat in this triangle in a particularly nice area of kind of main tree. We get a sense of what it was years ago. And we was all in this triangle of grass under a tree meditating for quite a while. And in the meanwhile there was men drinking in the pub, and one came out and had his cigarette, and I was aware of him for a little while, and then I wasn't. And he came out again, but it was clear he was watching. And I did wonder if he'd have the courage to come over, and he did. Mm. And I think for me, you know, when you're saying, can it have an effect?
Mm.
is that innate ability in all of us to respond to something other.
Mm.
It can happen to anyone at any time. Mm. And he came over and he was kind of apologetic for being drunk. Which saddened me a little bit, because I thought, no, you've seen something and you're responding to it, and that's great.
Mm.
And I just simply said to him, well, we're here every Wednesday, and just to make it, I suppose I was trying to ease it a bit, I did say, and sometimes we have a drink afterwards, as if to say, you know, your world can meet this world, it's not that alien.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why you're absolutely right to say what you said about Sainsbury's. It may not have led to tuna suddenly not being farmed in that way.
Mm-hmm.
But what you've given is an example, isn't it, to others that there are different ways of responding, effective, quiet ways, not shaming and hating for the media and things.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason that can't really strong what you're telling us.
Yeah, because I bet you weren't sitting there after your Qigong class thinking, I am trying to have an effect on people.
No,
just,
you know, chill out.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. No, really lovely to hear that. I think it's a really, really good question. Okay, so I've got a couple of, probably if you ask every person in this room, they'll come up with like strategies. First, there's something about if we're seeing through a lens of anger and blame, or anxiety, actually worry, what happens is we focus down on those parts of the world which seem a threat and which seem very difficult, dangerous, painful and scary. And what that means is that we're not open to the full perspective of all the things that are happening in the world that are positive, happy, good, joyful, creative. So if we manage to open up, so for a start we can sort of consciously try to balance things by not just seeing those aspects of the world, but also there is something about like when we if we're blocking an aspect of our experience, actually we're blocking a lot more than that. So we think we're blocking just the painful experience, like I don't want to think about that. But we're also blocking our sense of connection and our sense of delight and joy and being able to see pleasant things going on. And all that is being squashed and sat on because we're not able to be with the painfulness. So if we are able to stay with that level of experience, actually joy does arise quite naturally as well as the painfulness. But it's getting out, it's being able to step out of the kind of, I mean, for me it's often a horrified anxiety story, like everything's terrible and the world's going to pot and what's going to happen next. It's like I'm still in that story, so I'm still not with the direct pain of it. Is that making any sense or not?
Yeah. I guess, I think for me at the moment, I think I'm in touch with the direct pain, and I'm not having the rest of me. And I'm used to having the rest of me. I'm used to seeing the pros and the cons and the glass.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm not as in touch with it as I think. Maybe there's still another story to uncover.
Well, in a way, The process of becoming enlightened is just going through one story under another story under another story, and the final story is me and other. So we're always going through the levels of story. You know what? It's a really, really good question, Gurnam, and I'm tired and slightly zonked. And I think I might have a clearer answer tomorrow. but in a way, it is also a question that, like, each of us has to live. And I do this the whole time in my practice myself. It's like I try to go towards a painful area, and basically I kind of go, whoa, and I've gone into horrified anxiety, blame, fear. And then I kind of go back, and it's like the more like just the direct painfulness, and then I go, whoa. But it's not even like it's one or the other. It's like there's this whole kind of middle ground of like how much of those are we doing, and how much are we just able to kind of like be with the acceptance of it. But like I'm so not making out it's easy, okay, or like I've got it sussed, because I haven't.
It's very helpful to think about it for me, because you know, I just think about the Calais experience. I was here not long after I went to Calais, wasn't I?
Yeah.
I worked retreat in December. Mm. I spent a week in the jungle in October, 4 days and then 3 days, and it completely devastated me. Mm. And, you know, I mean, I was in touch. I felt so much compassion. I can, you know, I feel it now for families, little children, you know, these young men who sort of vilified for their just being young men. And I, you know, at the time I was sort of, I had some wonderful experiences. You know, some of the Sudanese boys said, can you have tea with us? You know, I sat in this beautiful kind of area. There were cats playing, there were a family of cats. It was like they'd formed their own retreat. You know, they were, one of them was cleaning the stove, one was peeling vegetables. You know, they were kind of in different, I really felt it like getting ready for the evening meal as well. And I was very inspired by the volunteers there, because you know there's thousands of them who are just giving up months of their lives to work there. But then I suppose physically it devastated me as well. But you know, and I can feel the compassion, and then I would move into anger and blame. Of course, I was blaming my group in Dawshin, my Buddhist women's group, for not doing enough. Not overtly, I wasn't even aware of it, but I was. The tone was very much a blaming tone. Anger and blame. And I, you know, I just move between them. I don't know if there aren't any easy solutions. I mean, the Brahma Viharas retreat was extremely helpful in May, because like you say, I found, you know, it's like saying, it's legitimate to feel joy in the middle of all this, you know, being one of the four Brahma Viharas. So that's kind of helpful. And equanimity, of course, to try and move towards that, to sort of soften some of the extremes. I don't know how, you know, I don't know. I mean, I'm still involved. I've not been back to Calais, but I'm very much part of, you know, the kind of raising funds and all the rest of it for refugees. I don't know how you, I suppose, yeah, the first stage is like things like this, isn't it? And really bringing it to consciousness. What are you feeling? What's the options? Finding an alternative, and finding a way of surviving, or being in touch with.
Yeah. Okay. Right. I completely don't know if I'm going to be able to express this. I probably won't. But let's have a quick shot before we all go and have a pee and head to the shrine room. But okay. So what it is it's like the world cannot be fixed on its own level. So this is what it's meaning by Kshitigarbha being the Bodhisattva of lost causes. So if Buddhist practice were able to fix the world in 2,500 years, it probably have done it. All the ideologies that we've had in the world, all the different philosophies, the different methods of government, communism, socialism, humanism, you know, Western democracy. If, you know, if there was a way within the world of fixing the world, I think it would have happened by now. And this is okay, and this is what I just don't know if I'm going to be able to express this, but it's like, this is where the transcendental element, I think, is just so important, because it's like the Dharma Niyama level that's just saying, I'm not going to be able to express this. I'm not going to be able to express this. Never mind. I'll try and come back to it tomorrow. It's like no, I'm sorry. Brain to fudge.
what you did though when you said that, I'll just say one more thing.
Yeah.
Is I do remember now that a number of the young men, because you know I were on the road and giving things to them and all the rest of it in the jungle, and I did a lot of listening. Which is, you know, kind of, yeah, listening and just being with it.
Yeah.
And for a number of them, I held their hands and said, because they'd say, we're going to jump the train tonight, and I held their hands and I said, your life is precious, stay safe.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I'm their mother's age, you know, at least.
Yeah, yeah.
And just maybe that's something I need to hold on to.
Yeah.
I'm not changing the world, but I was doing something that maybe had an effect.
Yeah. Yeah.
To kind of make that enough, if you like.
And it's like what you were doing there was you were breaking down a polarization.
Yeah.
So, you know, that could be a polarization between, like, you know, they could feel, why are all these rich white people not looking after us? And, you know, you could be feeling, why are all these people coming into our country and trying to take it off us?
I'm not, by the way.
No. I'm not saying you are.
Sorry.
But I'm just saying, like, I'm just, you know, you just get these polarizations. And the most basic polarization is there's me here and there's you there and we're different. So there's things I want and there's other things you want and I'm going to fight you for it. And it's like, so you were just stepping out of a polarization and you were saying, I really care about you like you were my son.
Mm-hmm.
Not that you would be saying those words.
Feeling.
Yeah, exactly. And that will have come across. Mm-hmm. And there's something just about that complete solidarity with life just being life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what else is there except to try and alleviate suffering? So that is you doing something. Which, you know, you can put all sorts of social services in place and yet that sense of solidarity not be there.
Mm. Is there also a sense, and I'm going to be really careful how I express this because I'm not suggesting, I am suggesting doing nothing in a way. I had an experience recently in reflecting a lot on Dharma Niyama forces and this sounds a bit dramatic, but you know, dark forces in the universe and positive forces in the universe. And I had a sense that where my suffering is at its greatest is if a force of the universe is moving through me and around me and within me, and I'm resisting it and I'm like a rock.
Mm.
But if I become like a leaf, and I don't mean this in an apathetic way, but if I'm just with whatever the force is, and I'm just like a leaf riding on the thermal or whatever, the suffering is less. But I'm not, there is an element of almost not doing anything, but I'm not saying you shouldn't have gone to the jungle and you shouldn't do anything. I'm not expressing it very well, really, but there is a sense of liberation in knowing that stuff is just happening. And we're not in control of it at all.
Yeah.
And actually, we can't, you're not going to eradicate the jungle overnight. I'm not saying you shouldn't try, but it's almost there's a liberation in knowing that it's not going to be resolved overnight. I know that sounds a bit hopeless.
What you're trying to express is a central koan, which, and actually, like, quite often, these archetypal figures, that, like, they're holding two things together where you think, well, either it's like this or it's like that. So either there's acceptance or there's action. And actually, it's like, so this is exactly what Kshitigarbha is trying to say. He's trying to say, with this level of acceptance, that there are conditions just rolling on and we are not in control of them. Actually, stopping fighting the fact that the world is really painful leaves us freer, more liberated, to be able to do the action where we think, ah, I could, and you don't even think it, do you? You know, you didn't think, oh, what a good idea, I'll hold that young man's hand and tell him to be careful. It's like, there's something in you where you've got a level of caring, where you're able to be with that, because I don't suppose you were angry at that moment. Yeah, exactly. So and if you had have been angry in that moment, like, I can't bear it that they're going to jump the trains, you would not have been able to step into that moment of connectedness. Exactly. So at that moment, there is total acceptance of the fact that there is this level of suffering in the world and there's nothing you can do about it. And you would have been in the best possible position to do the action that you could do, which was that act of connectedness. And it's like, they sound different and they're the same. Although obviously you can get action, you can split them, but actually that's not what Kshitigarbha is talking about.
You can do something as well, even you can counteract those dark forces by practicing metta.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Just the fact that you're sitting and you're practicing metta is having an effect on the universe.
Meditation is an act in the world. Yeah. Yeah.
Strangely, during a metta, Donald Trump popped into my head, and that's where this whole thing came from. So
was it the fourth stage?
It was the fifth, actually. I was thinking about.
He's definitely an all being.
Well, I was thinking about him for some reason. Into my head initially as a dark force in the universe, but it was also actually I don't get to choose not to send some metta out to Donald Trump, which is loathe everything he stands for. I don't get to choose, I'm afraid. I can't just send metta to people in the jungle, I have to send it to people like Donald Trump as well.
Yeah,
I think he needs it.
He really does. If anybody needs it, he does.
Oh, and direct action is such good fun. Like, I imagine, it's good, you know, at one level, it's good fun, isn't it? It's being outside Sainsbury's.
Oh, right, sorry. I thought you said Derek Daxon, and I was thinking, who's that? This is American politician. I had failed to hear.
I was back to the John West protest.
Yeah.
And I've done that.
Yeah,
really good fun.
I know. I must say, I'm
slightly naughty.
I'm so up for more. I'm so up for more. Right, I'm feeling like we should head to the Shrine Room, otherwise we're not going to. So it's going to be very, very simple. We're going to go in there. We're going to sit for a minute. We're going to chant Kshitigarbha's mantra and make offerings, and then we're going to go to bed. Okay, so you don't have to feel like it's going to be this whole big thing.
Fantastic talk, thank you. Enjoyed it, thank you very much. I'm going to bed now.
Fine, great.
Can I just check, on Wednesday, are other people giving talks as well as me?
No, it's just you.
Okay.
It's you and a Pooja.
Me and a Pooja.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Reinvigorated tomorrow.
Yeah,
well.
Me too. Night night.
Thank you.